Welcome, 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 and thank you so very much for joining me on another episode of Talking Cloud. Now, you know, this is where we talk about cloud, all things cloud, anything cloud. There's nothing that we won't talk about. And come on, let's face it, man. Everything is cloud today, one way or the other. Even your on-premises connecting into the cloud. And we do like to try to have a little bit of a slant towards security. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, being in this business like a dinosaur, I know a lot of really smart folks. And so I think what we end up trying to really achieve is having good conversations that you all will find interesting. And, you know, I've said many times before, I'm the Gilligan in this equation. My guests are the professors. And today, man, I'm super excited because I've known John for, holy moly, since like 2012, I think. I was at, I think when I first met this guy, I was at Blue Coat, and he... when we first met, we kind of just like got on like a house fire, and I was so flattered because I remember, the guy who handled analyst relations, called me, Tony Taddy, and he says, "Hey, John wants you to come to the dinner." And I just was like so flattered that there was this analyst dinner and that, you know, this analyst, wanted me to be there. And, so let me tell you about this guy, because this is going to be a fun discussion. It's too bad we can't go forever. 87, he starts at EMC Corporation. So, you know, as he put it in his profile back then, EMC was pretty small, but great business education. And then he went through a few different things, ClearPoint Research. You'll notice there's going to be a theme here because he comes back to that. Channel marketing and director of channel at Epoch Systems. I think I'm saying that right. Then he spent 4 years as a senior analyst at Forrester, went off with a group of ex-EMCers and did a stint for a couple of years as VP marketing and strategy at a company called Giant Loop Network. But then he found his home. And for the next 20 whatever years, it looks like, 21 plus years, he has been with a company we all know if we're in the tech industry, Enterprise Strategy Group. He was senior principal analyst, distinguished analyst, and ESG fellow. I think that's when I met him at RSA, or maybe... I think it was RSA. I think it was RSA. Then he went on into semi-retired. So that's why we're fortunate to have him today. But I've got Mr. John Oltzik with me today, all the way from the East Coast back there in New England. John, it's great to see you. Great to have you on the program, man.
Thanks, Grant. That was quite the intro, but I appreciate it. And it's good to be here, too.
Yeah, well, you know, I remember, seriously, I remember going back visiting you multiple times. I remember we did some live broadcasts with ESG. I always thought it was really cool. You were always just, you were always really willing to give, you know, me time. And I always enjoyed working with you. But let's talk about you and this industry. So you just jump into EMC. Anything before that? I mean, what were you doing before you got into when you went to EMC way back when you were a young man in 1987?
A young man. Well, I did spend several years as a vagabond. And after college, I was an English major at college. I was about to be certified to teach high school English. And I decided that I didn't really have the stomach at 22 to teach 17 and 18 year olds. So I spent a few years working in restaurants. I worked in all on the East Coast at that time, Nantucket Island, mm-hmm. in the summer, Stowe, Vermont in the winter. And then I decided that if I didn't do something, I was going to end up as a burnout. Vagabond was okay. Burnout was not. And so I went back, and I actually went back to my undergrad school, UMass Amherst. And I took some classes. Then I got into their MBA program. And so I was hired out of the MBA program at EMC. And the ironic thing is I knew absolutely nothing about computers at that time. I had no training. I kind of fudged my way out of the MIS class, Management Information Systems, during my MBA program. And ironically, I got a job at EMC. I will say at the time in the 80s in the Boston area, if you were in your 20s or 30s, you probably worked at a tech company because that's when digital was around and Data General and Wang and all those companies. So,
yeah, that was a hotbed.
That's how I ended up there.
That's fascinating. So one of the things you and I have in common, John, is that, you know, when I got into this industry, I helped open an Apple dealership. It was in 83. I couldn't spell computer. I mean, didn't know anything about them at all. And now, boom, all of a sudden I was in the business. But I think it's a testament really to you and your aptitude and your intellect to be able to navigate the waters. I mean, you don't stay in the industry for 30 years without being able to survive and I would argue thrive when you're with, you know, ESG for better than two decades. So you clearly figured some stuff out, but I was thinking when we met, you, I think, had just become a ESG, the fellow, or shortly thereafter. That was when that kind of part of your career.
No, actually, so I didn't become a fellow until the last couple of years, but it was the big move was principal analyst and senior principal analyst. ESG didn't have a principal analyst, so I was the first person to get that title.
So, you know, I mean, that's, let's talk about ESG and, you know, your influence on that organization, because I think it was pretty significant. I mean, you were the one that essentially spearheaded some of the organization's focus around security and network security. Am I wrong on that? Help me.
No, that's accurate. So, in fact, when I joined, it was called the Enterprise Storage Group. And a lot of my career was back to EMC, but the founder was an ex-EMCer, an old friend, and he wanted to diversify the company. And at the time, I come out of, as you mentioned, a telecommunication and networking company. But I discovered really through talking to my beacons in the industry. So I always, to this day, I've always had people that I really believe are extremely smart, extremely well connected, extremely insightful.
Thanks for
mentioning those things. And I feel like every time, and you're, Grant, you're kind of one of those guys.
I like the kind of part. That word was the perfect inclusion.
Well,
thank
we don't
you,
talk
John.
Enough, or I'd put you in that club. But when I talk to someone like you, Grant, I always feel like I'm smarter after the call. So I reached out to my beacons in the industry and I said, if you were me, what would you do? And a number of them said, look, you've got this background in network management. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that happen in network and systems management will happen in security. And security is a really burgeoning area. So you should look into it. And I did. And I got a bunch of books out of the library and started to read them and talk to people. And I decided, yeah, this looks very interesting. I like it. So I went to my friend Steve Duplessis, who was the founder of ESG. And after many a dinner meeting and, you know, the associated cocktails and things that go on with dinner meetings, we decided to give it a shot. And so I joined. And subsequently, we said, well, we need a new name. And we looked at ESG and said, well, let's just change the S to strategy. And there we were.
Brilliant.
But I did found the security practice at ESG, and now I think there are 5 analysts there, even after I left. So that's I'm pretty proud of that.
You should be. I mean, that's and you know, quite frankly, insightful. If you know, hindsight's always 20/10, right? I mean, when we look back, we can always cite the correct choice or path. If there is a correct one, I guess, but to have the insight and the chutzpah to say, hey, yeah, let's give that a try. I think that's pretty awesome, especially considering, you know, how long ago it was. So, but that was back in the days when really, I mean, what were the use cases for security that you were, you know, I mean, I always talk in analogies, sometimes stupid ones, but, you know, I always say back in the early days when I first joined Checkpoint, right, in 98, the use cases, there were 2, firewall, VPN. You know, I mean, it was like nobody, from our perspective, nobody else seemed to really care about the other, you know, weighted fare queuing and quality of service and how we could integrate it in with the policies. You know, there was such a crazy frenzy in that 98, 99 era where I just want to get out of the fishbowl I'm in, Token Ring, Banyan Vines, Novell, and I want to get into the ocean with everybody else, the internet. But as soon as they did, they went, oh, I better get that fishbowl back, right? And I think that was really where the firewall just went crazy.
Yeah, there were, in my view, there were 3 products at the time. This is myopic, and I'm sure someone will say, no, there were more than that. And there probably were. But there were 3 main products, let's say. Yep. There were firewalls, there was antivirus software, and due to a company named ISS, which you and I remember, but maybe others don't, there was the IDS.
Yep.
And so it was a very, very technical world.
Boy, I'll
which
say.
I guess was good at the time because I learned a ton.
Yeah.
But the thing that I guess the thing that I came in with was by that time, by the early 2000s, if you were in the tech industry, you could no longer just live on selling speeds and feeds. You had to put a business angle on it. You had to you had to make that association between technology and business value. And that really didn't exist in the security world. And I kind of knew it would I knew it would come.
Eventually.
And so I came in with that attitude, and it took a long time, but we're certainly there today.
Oh, I would argue we're there in spades. I mean, I literally get onto my knees. I mean, I feel so fortunate that I've managed to somehow stumble into security. In the industry that I stumbled into, technology, computers, right? Because it's pretty remarkable. You know, I was just looking up something as you were talking about IDS. And do you remember Mark Willebeck? He was the co-founder.
Mark Willebeck Lemaire, I think is his name.
That's right. You're right. Sorry. Thank you.
He was a Tipping Point guy.
Tipping Point. Exactly. Exactly. Boy, and that was such a big deal.
When I came in, that was a major security player. Real thought leader.
To be in line. Because that was the big thing that they believed, right? Because they were IPS.
Yes. In fact, the week that I started, the Monday I started at ESG was, I believe, the Monday after the Friday when Gartner had published their paper that said IDS is dead. It's all IPS. So that was my introduction to IDS/IPS.
Yeah, I had him. I had him as a guest on the program talking about Spiderbat, which is a company that he's now a founder and CEO of.
He's still at it.
Yeah, but that when you mentioned IDS, I remember that was such a big deal. But it was also like, to a certain degree, you can also step back and look at the evolution of things like what a firewall does today or can do, as opposed to, I mean, it was doing much more than a full stateful inspection and keeping up with the traffic flow was about all you could really put on it. You couldn't lay on all this additional processing burden, right? That's why you.
It was too expensive.
It was too expensive and too expensive for CPU. You know, the user experience would just go into the dumper.
Yeah, that's what I mean. There was always a sacrifice between performance and efficacy.
Yeah.
And I remember Juniper set the world on fire because they had the fastest firewall at the time.
Yep. NetScreen.
Yeah. But I mean, these things change. And I mean, if you said, well, what did you get wrong in your career? A friend of mine called me one time and said, hey, should I take the job as VP of sales at Palo Alto? And I said, it's just a firewall. And it kind of is. It's just a firewall. And firewalls had evolved up to that point. But I mean, Palo Alto figured out not only just the technology, but they were a marketing machine. So,
yep. I think that's one of the things that, you know, obviously being at Checkpoint, you know, Nir's 10-year education at Checkpoint before he went and started Palo, and they've done very well. I think there's one of the considerations that I always throw out that something that really is a difference that doesn't get discussed much is we went public in 96. So, you know, we have zero debt and nothing but money, you know, in the bank. That in and of itself changes the complexion of the two organizations, right? Because what's fueling that marketing machine is a bunch of guys standing behind the curtain going, man, I hope we're going to hit this one big. You know, I mean, they're all looking for their big payoff.
No, and it's pretty incredible. Like if I think back to when I started, the big names in the industry, and then I fast forward to today, there aren't many besides Checkpoint that I can think of that are still standing, still independent. You know, I guess I'd put Cisco in that category, but Cisco's kind of had great years in security and then some down years. But Checkpoint's been slow and steady as she goes. I mean, who else? Back in those days, I mentioned ISS, Symantec. Then there were companies like IntelliTactics and Net Forensics. And I mean, and as you said, Tipping Point, they're just, I mean, those. You have to be as old as us, Grant, to even remember those companies, let alone appreciate what they did at the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you something that I this was an analogy that I came up with, John, when I first started selling computers and I didn't know anything. OK. And we're talking 1983 and it's going to sound kind of funny, maybe stupid funny, but this was, you know, 6 months before the Mac came out, right? And the popular item for an Apple dealer was the Apple IIe, was the brand new one, had 64K of memory on board and has a slot for an 80-column text card. You'll remember the normal display was 40 columns, which meant a half a page. So when you had two lines on the screen, if you printed it off on a printer, it would be one line. It was dreadful. So you always wanted to be able to display 80 columns. Okay. Apple offered an 80-column text card for, I think it was like $89.99, right? Excuse me. They also offered an extended 80 column text card that gave you that same 80 columns and doubled your memory to 128K. Now, I know we're laughing, but that's a rinse and repeat story. I think that's the point there. It started long, long ago. And I knew I had to overcome this. Well, Grant, do I really need 64K? I mean, is 128K? Isn't 64K enough? And I mean, it's just like, it's laughable, but this I heard over and over. And I saw that it caused me to like really think, how can I explain why it's so important to buy that extra memory? And this is what I came up with. I drew a wave, like, you know, just a two-dimensional wave on a piece of paper. And I said, what happens to this wave out in the middle of the ocean when it's not moving? There is no wave. I mean, a fundamental principle of a wave is it's moving. Well, that's technology. And I said that the water in front is the new stuff. The water behind is the obsolete stuff. You want to buy as high and as close to the white water as you can, but not too far over, because that's 0.8 or 0.9, right? Or beta. You want to get to where you can hang 10, but that gives you the longest life cycle before you have to reinvest, or you can expect to be still water behind the wave. And if you accept or that analogy or metaphor, as a company, the only way you stay in that wave is to continue to innovate, to continue to add value, to have solutions for use cases that are relevant in the marketplace. That's it. Otherwise, you're also still water behind the wave. Mm-hmm. And you know, no pun intended, or maybe intended, it still holds water today on that whole notion of, you know, the waves are much bigger in that analogy, but you still have to. If the company is not continuing, if Checkpoint wasn't continuing to add value, we would go the way of all the others that are still water, right? I mean, I really believe that. And I think that that is why you continually have a churn in this business. But I'm curious to hear, what do you think's enabled us to do that so effectively?
Well, first, from a market perspective, there's been a lot of consolidation. So in effect, Symantec still exists. McAfee still exists. They just were acquired. And now you have to have, like I said, a long memory to remember those brands. Maybe not those brands, but others.
Fair enough.
The key in security, though, to me, is to really, and I mean really, understand your customer. And because it's not speeds and feeds, and this is, I can't take credit for this. This is really something that IBM, it's an internal IBM thing, but they say there are speeds and feeds. So there's the vendor and the customer. With security, there's a third party, and that's the adversary. And so it doesn't, like, you can make your firewall or whatever technology faster, but if it's not filtering the right packets, if it doesn't catch those attacks in progress, then it's not good. So you really have to listen to your customers. Now, doing that is getting harder and harder, in my view, because a healthcare organization and a financial services organization have different needs. They have different regulations. They have different staffing issues. They have different adversaries. The threats are different. And the good security companies recognize that and work with their customers. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest things I think as a security vendor is to really focus on customer success, because it doesn't matter how good your technology is in the lab. It's how well it's deployed, tuned, maintained.
Yep.
And I think Checkpoint's done a wonderful job at not only keeping up with those things, but working with its customers and, in Checkpoint's case, with its distribution channel to make sure that all those cogs are well oiled and working together.
Apple used to have a line I learned that I think really holds true. And I think Checkpoint does a pretty good job of hanging on to this. And that is, a tool in and of itself has no inherent value. And the true value of any tool is its ease of learning and ease of use. And I, yes. You know, and that was one of the one of the premises or mantras that, you know, you'd hear that was behind the Macintosh, right? That they looked at everything from the other side of the glass, you know, and that was real noticeable. You remember back in the 80s and through the 90s, the administrative tools, for example, often weren't looked at from the glass side, right? They were just looked at getting a job done.
They were utilities.
Yes. And they didn't really
solve them.
And they were a pain in the butt. And it's changed a lot. There seems to be much more focus on that, on the user experience. It plays such a critical role in many products and platforms, I think, today, don't you?
I do, and hopefully, and I'm not going to get on a hyperbole bully pulpit here, but hopefully this is where generative AI can really help, is the generative part.
Right.
Telling us what we might, not what we should do, but what we might consider doing, educating junior people, being a helper app for more senior people.
The things we might be missing also, right? I mean.
Exactly. So. Something that tells me, you know, your EDR really isn't configured well against these types of threats that affect your region, your industry.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. Why didn't I tune it right? Well, maybe the guy who was our EDR administrator left. Maybe I had a managed service provider. Who knows?
Yeah.
But if we can make the tools easier to not only deploy, but to optimize, then we're in much better shape.
Yeah, and I think that is a tsunami that's hitting us right now with the myriad of co-pilot implementations that you're seeing. In fact, I think Checkpoint just announced today a partnership with Microsoft and their co-pilot technology. So to even tighten the laces in securing Azure environments.
Okay.
And you know, Checkpoint, I think, has done a fabulous job because we've been using machine learning engines for years. And I think Dorit, you know, Dr. Dorr, she's definitely out on the edge with what we're doing with AI, and evidence of it is how it's going to come into fore across, you know, the entire portfolio, which is, I mean, it's pretty exciting. So there's speaking of AI, I always have to give a plug for this video. And I like to ask, have you seen the AI Dilemma? It's on YouTube. It's from the Center for Humane Technology. And man, I know your schedule's tight these days, John, but carve out an hour, 7.5 minutes, go to YouTube, the AI Dilemma. I really think it's a very, you know, it's a little, there's parts of it, I'll admit, that can be a little bit of a doomsdayer, like, you know, there's a dark cloud over us. It certainly talks about the amazing things, but it does highlight some of the things we should be concerned about, right? But I really encourage you to look at it. And it just is really interesting when you start to consider the impact of having an assistant with an IQ of 1,000, dumb as a rock, without very specific instructions on what to do, right? Because that's kind of the era we're getting into. But I think it's going to be profound, the impact it's going to have on both sides of the war. Because,
yes,
I just read about, I'd have to look up the name of it. But it was, it's this available on the dark net bot that does some really gnarly bad stuff, you know?
Yeah, there's already quite a bit of that. While I was still at ESG, I'm still sort of associated with ESG as an analyst emeritus. But we did some research and we asked security professionals, who gains the advantage, adversaries or defenders?
Mm-hmm.
76% of those who we surveyed said adversaries.
Hmm.
So as with any new technology, people are afraid of some of the ramifications. And by the way, that is amplified all the time in the press. You can't look at any tech website without seeing some really kind of draconian language around what AI could do.
No doubt.
But my perspective on that is that I want people scared. And here's why. So if I'm the CISO, I want my people scared because I want them tracking adversary behavior. I want them understanding what's going on in the deep dark web, what's going on in terms of development of TTPs. I want them looking at MITRE and looking at CISA and looking at some of the threat reports from Checkpoint and others, because we don't know what the threats are yet. And we do know that this is a fast moving area, a lot of innovation on both sides, as you said, and I don't want my organization to be unprepared. I want my threat analyst to say, we've just learned of this new type of use of AI. It's good for business email compromise, and here's what we should do about it. And then if I need budget, I can go to the executives and the board and give them concrete things, details about threats and about investments, and then we can measure the progress. So anyway, that's I'm kind of like I say, if the scales tilt that way, I think there's some goodness there.
So I was looking this up while you were talking, and this is some post that's saying this is Dark Gemini, a powerful new Gen AI chatbot being sold on the dark web for $45 a month. It can generate reverse shell, build malware, or even locate people based on an image. A next generation bot built specifically to make Gen AI more accessible to the hacker next door.
Well, it sounds like the hackers have good marketing, because that sounds pretty powerful. But we'll see. I mean, there are malicious ways you can use ChatGPT today. And then you can take some of the open source LLMs, build some rule sets around them, some generative content around them, and limit the filters. So there's lots of ways that this can be misused.
Yep.
And we have to be astute there.
Yep. It's interesting. You know, we just had, he was the ex-CEO of JetBlue. Peter, I should look up his name. He was on the stage with Dorit, and they were talking about AI. And he had a real interesting perspective, you know, where we had just awarded Prompt Security the award for Innovation Award. We had this contest between a bunch of different partners. And he came out, and his view was quite the opposite, you know, to not control it, to just make it private, to not use public, make sure you're using only private, but allow everyone to have access to it and everyone to put in. It was just quite interesting, his position compared to what you hear from others.
Yeah, we'll see. I think there'll be proprietary models. I think there'll be open models. I'm more, I guess I lean toward the open model because we can do things like collective defense if we have an open model. So if you're attacked and you're a big hospital in the Seattle area and I'm in the Boston area, I really want to know not only what the threat, which we are pretty good at exchanging that information, but I want to know what the best defense is.
Yep.
And so if you, maybe you get hit and we learn some lessons through you, well, that should be dissipated throughout the industry. And there's some privacy issues there, but I think eventually we can get there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, I think, you know, certainly from a architectural design, we'll propagate that information, right? But we certainly don't want to send it to our adversaries or our opponents or our so it'll be interesting to see how it could harmonize the industry with some source that could share that information. But you know, I'm certainly not going to start to share it on my own.
Yes. Yeah. It, like I said, that'll take some time. But in the meantime, there's some positive things going on that I'm bullish on.
Yeah, me too. So watch The AI Dilemma. You want to check it out. I know you've got a hard stop, and I wish we could keep going. Next time, I'll make sure I start with less stories before I hit record. And I
will block my calendar for a few hours.
Yeah, because we could talk. I mean, there's so many things that I'd love to just pull on with you, John. But what I can tell you, man, and I mean this from my heart, I've considered it an honor and a pleasure to have you as a friend. I've known you for, you know, a couple decades anyway. And a couple decades. I don't want to put it ahead too much. But I really appreciate you making time for me and coming on the program and chatting. And let's definitely have you back. Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to come back. It was really fun. It's a pleasure. And the same goes for you. I mean, I am going to be at RSA this year, so hopefully we can see each other face to face. But after 21 years, people I've worked with have become good friends, like you.
Yep.
And so I've learned a lot. I've enjoyed myself. And I hopefully I've contributed to the dialogue on cybersecurity and better defenses and things like that without sounding like Chicken Little.
No,
I appreciate the opportunity, Grant.
You've been a great voice. You continue to be in cybersecurity, John. As far as I'm concerned, you're kind of a legend, and I really appreciate you being on the program. So thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. I'll talk to you again soon.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to close out by saying I hope you enjoyed this. Look for the next episode, part two with John, because we definitely have to have it. We could go on for a while, but I really appreciate you being here, listening, subscribing, sharing, tell your friends, and we'll look forward to having you back on the next episode of Talking Cloud. Thanks so much.